summer now. She's still a 10-month contract. And she's like, you know, I don't have to do anything. She has a principal at lodging time, but she's still like, go to this and this all summer long.
I have two that are. Yeah, Julia's 16, almost 17. Caleb's 14, Claire's 11. Yeah. Yeah, so we're with Julia, we're thinking more about college and what she's going to be a senior next year, so starting to think about college and what all of that looks like. Oh, not even close. She knows what she excels at math and she excels at writing. And so she's trying to, just weigh what might that look like, and so we'll see. Yeah, it's, and when Christy and I went to college, it was starting to get expensive 20 years ago, or 25 years ago, and now it's just, it just keeps going up. So, and then thinking about three kids, they're gonna need lots of scholarships. They need some scholarships. So, well, it looks like we're give it another minute, and I think we'll get started. Yeah, that was for the first 2 weeks. This week doesn't have a handout, so. Going to my mom's, going to my mom and dad's, yeah, so.
We're actually going to my aunt's house, but my mom and dad will be there, and my 94-year-old grandmother will also be there.
Oh, wow, that's special.
It'll be the first time that all of us have seen her together since COVID started.
Wow.
But over 80% of her family now is back.
Wow. That's good. Well, good for you guys. Have a great time. Yeah. All right, we will go ahead and get started. And Mark, could you shut the door? I'm going to go ahead and, this is the attendance sheet. I'll just go ahead and pass this around. And let me open our time in prayer as we begin. Our Father, thank you for your goodness again. Thank you for the opportunity to teach, the opportunity to look into your word. This is your word that we get the opportunity to spend time in this morning. I pray that would never become routine or rote, but it would always be fresh to us. And just as believers, convict us, teach us, give us humble hearts. Bless our time this morning. Amen. Well, I was actually debating whether to cover this or not, because this is kind of a downer on Mother's Day. So please do not say afterwards, one of our pastors decided to talk about capital punishment on Mother's Day. There's no link between the two. It fit because we've been discussing government. And this is obviously very related to that and builds on what we had talked about. But in my heart, I kept thinking, I really don't want to cover this subject on Mother's Day of all days to do this. But here we are. So let's start. I went back and looked at the surveys. And each week, I'll share with you a little bit about just how the class as a whole answered some of these questions. So one of them was, one function of government is to manage our natural resources. So we'll just use the definition that we've been going with is government exists to manage creation. It's a land, sea, animals, manage creation, and to provide order by restraining sin. So the average score of the class was a 3.91. So fairly favorable, you know, that government, I think the class largely agrees that government should be managing natural resources. And, government has a right to do that, as we've kind of talked about from Genesis 1. Now, there's only a few of these questions that there's really a black and white, right or wrong answer. A lot of these are to kind of get you thinking a little bit. And that's really what this next question does. So I'll give you some things to think about with it. It says, there are times when government should be large. And that's not one anybody's really neutral on, no matter who I teach. You teach to conservatives, and it's going to be a very low number. You teach to liberals, it's going to be a very high number. Nobody's at like 3.5. So everybody has distinct opinions on this question. So where we were at was a 2.68. So pretty low. There are times when government should be large, so kind of, and that's, I'd anticipated, that's really where we're at, probably as a class, maybe as a church, that we really think government should be pretty small, never should be large. Like I said, other groups would say, oh yeah, it should be larger. But 2.68 would be the lowest of all the scores of all 21 questions. So answer is this, government needs to be large enough to accomplish really these two purposes. Large enough to manage the resources under its care, large enough to restrain sin, provide order. So what happens when a government isn't large enough to, not so much that first one, but the second, what happens when it's not large enough to restrain sin in a society? And I'm not talking about U.S. government, I'm just talking just philosophically, if a government's not large enough to do that, what's something that might happen?
Anarchy.
Well, yeah, an extreme would be anarchy. What's some of the other things that might happen? Even in our government, there are some things that it's not doing that it probably could do.
Profound rising crime.
You could have some profound rising crime. I visited South Africa several years ago, and I don't pretend to know a lot about their government. However, everywhere that I went, I mean, you're just really fearful of what's going to happen. And all the warnings people saying, just your wallet, keep that very hidden. Even in a car, don't have anything sitting out on the seat. Even while you're driving, don't have things sitting out on a seat. There's just so many warnings because there's so much crime. Government can't even address a fraction of it. So many things just go left undone. I have a missionary friend that's over there, and his car was stolen. This was a few years ago, and I think it's been stolen multiple times. So they keep getting new cars, and there's no recourse. There's no real recourse. You can report it, but nothing's really going to happen. And that's just, one of the people I was staying with had said that, the wife was just saying that, she was driving, had her purse just sitting in the passenger seat, stopped at a red light. A gentleman standing on the curb saw it, busted the window, took the purse, ran. And she said, this happens like pretty routinely, things like this. I mean, it's just that's what happens. If you have a government that's not large enough to deal with the sin in the society, that's the kind of life you're going to have to just, that's a normal life. So you want government to be, so the question isn't should it ever be large, should it ever be small, there really are times that it probably should be larger. The problem is it tends to grow these tentacles and becomes much larger than it legitimately should be. But any thoughts on that one or questions? Nancy.
Yeah, sorry.
No. Oh yeah.
And so corrupt that it also won't manage. So I don't know if it's synonymous to the size of government, the ability to be able to control, restrain sin. Like for instance, right now in Myanmar, the government's certainly there, and they are ransacking through people's homes. I don't know if there's necessarily. I mean, it can also go the other side as well.
It'd be this aspect of government. Needs to be large enough to restrain sin. However, you're absolutely right. It could be, I don't know if it's a size issue that it becomes corrupt or whatever, but it needs to be, the principle is just that it needs to be large enough to deal with the sin of society. However, you're getting into another issue that a lot of times governments, they do become corrupt just by their nature. You have sinners that are in them. You're going to see depravity working its way through. So, but it's helpful to at least start with a principle of how to think about this. But good point. Yeah, Phil.
I see two things of a mindset. Some people worship government as the ultimate say-so rather than government appointed by God. It's like you got the godless that believe in government and you got godly people that believe in government. And the two don't agree.
Sure, sure. Yeah, one of the differences in the classes I've taught, like when you're thinking about government big or small, it's a conservative would be someone who believes that government should have very little involvement in economic issues, but a whole lot of involvement in social issues. A liberal would be the very opposite. Government should have a lot of involvement in economic issues, not much involvement in social issues. A libertarian would say government shouldn't have involvement in either. So just real quick definitions, but a conservative, when we're talking about social issues, we're one saying that, well, yeah, when it comes to the sanctity of life, sanctity of marriage, when it comes to, recently we've been discussing the legalization of marijuana in a lot of states. Conservatives say, yeah, those are social issues. Government should be involved in those. Liberals are saying, no, we think of small government in social issues. So it's really economic issues we want small. Liberals want large. In social issues, we want large. They want small. So it's not just, it gets complicated when you start to think about this. It's different areas that you're saying government should be big or small. So biblically, where I'm at, I'm a conservative. I'm not a liberal. I'm not a libertarian. I'm a conservative. I do believe that because man is sinful, government should have a large role in restraining sin, social issues. Economic, there's some cases I can see, but largely I don't see a lot of support for that biblically. So I'm just to tell you what my bias is, I'm a conservative. So we'll move on. Getting into this week, capital punishment. And a picture of a lady justice. You can see she's blindfolded. So she's not able to see and take sides in a case, but just has the scales of justice in her right hand and weighing a case, blindfolded, trying to be as objective as possible, has a sword in her left hand, represents executing justice swiftly. And there's a lot to ask about this. Who determines what is just? One of the questions on the survey from the other week was just, government should submit to the authority of the Bible. Well, if you said it shouldn't, well then, who determines what's just? As a Christian, I support to the authority of Scripture. I believe there's one God, and I think everything ought to submit to this God. So He determines what is just. But what punishment's appropriate? If it's the death penalty, how swift? When is a jury heard sufficient evidence to decide? So in principle, we're going to talk about this in principle, but towards the end of our time in practice. In principle, I think it's pretty clear. In practice, it gets pretty difficult. It can get kind of murky answering some of these questions. So definition, it's just capital punishment, the legally authorized taking of a person's life for a crime. So legally authorized. A history leading up to it. Well, not leading up to it, but a history. Ancient Babylonians and the Assyrians, family would decide the method of execution. So if you had a brother that government determined was going to be executed for a crime, well, you would be one of the people deciding how your brother's going to be executed. They'd put that burden on the family. Romans, beheading or crucifixion, the Visigoths, the Vikings, a lot of the medieval warlords, just a variety of very imaginative, really, really wicked kinds of executions. They took delight in execution. England under King Henry VIII, death penalty for 72,000 in his 36-year reign. He was basically judge, jury, and executioner, and it was swift. If you offended Henry, when you're talking about 72,000, he couldn't possibly have reviewed even a fraction of these cases. It was just, off like that, just killing people. So a very bloody king, very wicked king in a lot of ways. In fact, one of my heroes, William Tyndale, he was the first man who translated the Bible from Greek and Hebrew into English, executed under King Henry VIII, for translating the Bible into English. Ironically enough, within 2 years of that, Henry said, oh yeah, I want the Bible in English all throughout England. So it's very back and forth, but 72,000 were executed. British Empire expanded capital offenses to 160 crimes in the 18th century. So you can see why, from some of this, and rightly so, there was a reaction to the death penalty with this kind of thing. Innocent people frequently died, even children. Punishment often didn't fit the crime, something akin to shoplifting today. People were executed for it at times. So this really gets to what Nancy was saying about government can be corrupt, and we all agree, but government abusing the authority that God has given. Executions were normally inhumane. They were shame-based. The Roman crucifixion, when you think about just the crucifixion of our Lord, it's not as if that took place in a sterile kind of environment, nobody's around, really secretive. No, it happened during Passover. You had, perhaps, it's estimated, up to 1 million people coming to Jerusalem, and they would have put that cross in the most visible place possible. So just a horrible, horrible way to die. French guillotine was very much the same way. We're going to do this in the town square, and we're going to really celebrate this. It was just really, really horrible stuff. Public, highly visible torture. So none of this is, there's no need to really go into any depth with that, but it's just, that's why there was such a reaction to this. American history. At present, we have, to my knowledge, 41 federal capital offenses. 39 of those are murder-related. So we're talking about like genocide, murder for hire, assassination. The only exceptions are espionage and treason of those 41. So gradual move towards abolition of the death penalty that started in the 18th century. So more and more people were just growing outraged at what was happening, and rightly so. So again, we can talk about it biblically. There's the principle that we're going to get to. Practically, what's happening doesn't always align with what should be happening. Governments repeatedly abusing horrible degrees what they could do. How many executions, out of curiosity, just a trivia question, how many executions have been performed in the United States? Any idea? Just throw out a number. 28. Who said 28? 28. 1,500 since 1972, when the death penalty was declared unconstitutional. So since, and then 1976 was reinstated, 1,500 have been performed and since the 70s. What'd you say, Dave? 5,000. That's pretty close. The founding of the country. Yeah, it would be, it was hard to find a figure on this, but 6,000. So about 6,000 executions since the founding of the country, 1,500 since 76. Franklin had said it is better 100 guilty persons should escape than that one innocent person should suffer. So very interesting. So we go back to scripture, verse that we've been looking at. If you go to Genesis chapter 1, it's always hard to find Genesis because it's the very first few pages. Bible doesn't ever fall open to Genesis or Revelation very easily. But Genesis chapter 1, verse 26 and 27 says, "Then God said, 'Let us make man in our image according to our likeness, and let them, men and women, rule over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the sky, over the cattle and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth.' And so God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Man and female, he created them." So image and likeness. Those are two key words that we're looking at. We've talked about this throughout our time together, but image and likeness. Image refers to a statue, a painting, or a representation of another. So man being created in the image of God, the idea is like a statue, a painting, something like that, something that resembles. Ancient kings erected statues all throughout their dominion. You probably remember this from 2 weeks ago, but ancient kings would erect these different statues throughout their dominion. So if you're going into their territory and you see a statue of that king in his image, it looked like him, it was a sign that, oh, this is that king's dominion. This is where he rules, has authority to reign. So when you saw that, people, what the text is saying is that men and women are God's image. So God putting men and women on earth and saying, be fruitful and multiply. Why? That everywhere throughout the face of the earth, the image of God would be. As the song says, this is our Father's world, and we are to be representatives of Him everywhere. That was the ideal. So that they may have dominion that is governed the land, the sea, the animals in ways that are pleasing to God. Likeness refers to a similarity, which reduces our status. We are not gods on earth. We are not divine, nothing of that sort. We are only like God in this way. So I know we've covered that in 2 weeks ago, but the idea is just we are uniquely created to be God's ambassadors on earth, created to represent His authority over all other things. So I'll move forward from there, but it tells us that we have, people have dignity just by virtue of being a human being, a dignity that animals do not have. Whole load of implications for that, just how we treat one another, how we talk to one another, how we value one another, how we value human life. Genesis 9, fast forwarding to, oh, there we go, down a little ways, says every moving thing, this is after the flood, every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. And as I gave you the green plants, I give you everything. But you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is, its blood. And for your lifeblood I will require a reckoning. From every beast I will require it, and from man. From his fellow man I will require a reckoning for the life of man, that whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed, for God made man in his own image. Right there at that very end, why in the world is murder so wrong? It's not just because we exist or because we don't like it. It's we're the image of God. That's why it's bad. So two of the two prohibitions that are mentioned in this text, the first, but you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is its blood. And the second, and for your lifeblood, I will require a reckoning. In English, it doesn't really show this, the parallel structure, but it's two very strong prohibitions of what people are not to do. And this wasn't given to Israel, obviously. This was given to Noah and extends to all of humanity. Universal commands here. So the first, God gave Noah and his descendants these prohibitions. The first is not really talked about too much. But the first is man is not to eat a live animal. So what this is getting at is bloodlust, like torture, enjoying. I mean, you think about the world where it was in Genesis 4, the violence that we talked about last week, how wicked it was. It makes sense God saying, don't do that. just because an animal is not the image of God, just because it's just an animal, just because you're bigger than it, you don't have the right to go and just torture it and eat it alive and wicked, just animal cruelty is what this is getting at. So don't tear the animal to shreds while it's moving. It's amazing just how wicked the world was that God had to actually make a command not to do this. One commentator says that even when we slaughter and kill, man is to know that he's touching something which, because it is life, is in a special manner God's property. And so it's not just a deer or just a dog God created this. And so, of course, it's not of the same dignity or status as we are, not at all. But this is something God created. There's a certain respect that ought to be had. Does that make sense? That's kind of an probably a command that it seems unexpected, but again, it just gives you an idea of just how wicked the world, the heart of man can be. Phil?
American Indians seem to have a real connection that way with its surroundings, the cycle of life.
Well, I don't want to connect. It's not connected to that. I mean, that's more like pantheism, and we're not. God isn't in everything at all. Yeah. And there ought to be an appreciation, certainly. But again, I mean, the idea is not that God is in animals and nothing weird like that. So the prohibition dealing with capital punishment. Why is this in? There we go. Well, my slides are a little messed up here. But man is not to murder others. Life for a life. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. So justice is Godward, is an important principle with this. I'll give a few principles in just a minute, but justice is always Godward. It's not about us and for other whatever reasons we may come up with, but it's always about God. His glory has been offended. He has been offended. And that's why he says, I will require. So it's not primarily about us or about government, about society. It's primarily and always about God himself. Sin is always about God, right? David says in Psalm 51, against you only have I sinned. David had sinned with Bathsheba, against Israel, against Bathsheba, against Uriah, against his own family. I mean, the list goes on. He had committed murder. He had lied. All of these horrible things. And he says, against you, God, against you only have I sinned. Not because the others he hadn't sinned against, but because sin is so much against God, infinitely more against God than it is even the people you directly sinned against. God is offended. And that's really the idea with capital punishment. Yeah, if you've murdered somebody, you have committed, you've done something that's irreparable, you have harmed that family, you have sinned against other people. But 10,000 times greater than that is how offended God is by what's happened. And that's why this punishment exists. So does that make sense?
It's easy to see when you look at the very first murder, right?
With Cain and Abel.
Cain and Abel, and God's punishment against him was that it was literally a lifelong punishment, right? That the earth will be cursed against you forever. You will walk among the earth. And it will spring up weeds and thorns, and clearly he was, egregious to his very core, against that murder. It was very clear, and that was one of the few times where we see where he literally doles out personal punishment for that type of crime. This is you.
Sure.
Punishing.
Yeah, that was a little unique because God didn't take Cain's life. Now when it comes to just the authority of government, he's saying, I'm charging you because my glory has been offended, my righteousness has been offended. I'm charging human government to not make it right, but justice requires that life for a life. So God made man in his own image. John Davis, commentator, writes, when violence in the form of murder is done to a man, it is in effect an outrage against God. Sometimes we forget that. We forget that when, in terms of this discussion. We also forget that in terms of our own lives. Sin is always against God. We need to go to the person that we've offended, but realizing God has been offended 10,000 times more than that person in any given sin. Sin is always about him. So Psalm 51. There we go. Biblical principles. It says the authority in Genesis 9, the authorities, not vigilantes, are implied. So we don't just hire people to go around and just arbitrarily dole out capital punishment, or even crimes in general. We don't just arbitrarily dole out whatever. but it's implied that a government, you're going to have some kind of a justice system is implied that's going to weigh the case. You see that hashed out a bit with Israel later, and starting in the book of Exodus. But you're not going to just have a family saying, "Well, you killed my brother, so I'm going to go kill you." That wasn't what the idea of Genesis 9. So it implies some kind of a government that's going to do this. The authorities have a duty to execute murders because it says, "I will require a reckoning." And again, it's not society requires a reckoning. It's not that family requires a reckoning. It's God saying, "I require a reckoning." So that gets lost. Again, I think that gets lost in a lot of these discussions. When I was in the Capitol, it was always discussions of it was always discussions of finances, practicality was discussed, but it was never discussed in light of this kind of subject. Was never discussed in light of God, and that's ultimately what it comes down to. The process should be a deterrent to murderers, and I say this because going back to Genesis 4, given. It was given to prevent violence from engulfing the world once again. As bad as things got in Genesis 4 leading up to the flood, then afterwards God's saying, "I'm instituting this capital punishment." It was supposed to be a deterrent to what had come before. And I think it definitely was. It's argued, we'll talk in a little bit, but it's argued in our country whether it's a deterrent anymore. When you have people that are on death row for 20, 25 years, does that really deter? I don't know that it really fulfills its purpose in that way. But the idea, the principle at least, is this was supposed to be a deterrent to violence engulfing the world once again. The execution should be humane. Again, how do you define humane? But the principle, I think, stands. It should be humane, God, because man is God's image. That rules out a lot of the things that I had talked about what in the history of capital punishment, where you had torture and you had... It was public, it was shame-based. Man is God's image, so this is a very serious thing. This is when government says we're taking this person's life due to murder, and the way that we carry it out is in recognition we're doing this as people who are accountable to God for how we're doing it, for our doing it, and how we're doing it. So it's always about, it's always Godward. The reason, as I said, is Godward. God is supremely offended. It's not given to provide vengeance or to provide closure. And a lot of the discussions that I've heard are along those lines, that it gives some kind of closure to the families or that have been offended, or it provides, I've even heard a lot of discussions like vengeance. This is, you know, he did this and this was what ought to be done to him. And that has nothing to do with a Christian understanding of this. Capital punishment is never a cause for rejoicing. And it should grieve us. It should grieve us when it comes to that. And it should also grieve us when you look. I think about on just images I'd seen on television where we don't see we don't hear really about executions done in our country anymore. There are some, but it's pretty rare. And but I remember growing up, and I think it was Carla Faye Tucker, who was executed in Texas under Governor George W. Bush. And she had become a Christian, and there was a lot of talk on whether she was a real Christian and this and that. Well, she was executed, but in any one of these kinds of things, there's always people outside just clapping and rejoicing. And I mean, that's really completely wrong. It ought to grieve us when something like this happens, even if it is just. So the major objections, so now we'll transition a bit from the principle. I do think, just to be clear, I do think capital punishment is biblical, but that's a different question. Now, what does that look like practically? And when are some times where you may not support it? Main objections, innocent people will die. That's true. It's a cruel and unusual punishment in all circumstances, which means it violates the Eighth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. That's why in 1972, it was declared unconstitutional, because the justices of the Supreme Court said it violates the Eighth Amendment. All forms of capital punishment are cruel and unusual. The standards used from different states are arbitrary, which to some degree they kind of were. It was kind of a hodgepodge of standards. So they said, we're getting rid of it until we can come up with something more consistent. Third, life in prison is a worse punishment than the death penalty. So this one would be vengeance. I've heard different lawmakers that in 2011, when it was outlawed in Illinois, different ones stood up and said, when, you know, what's worse than the death penalty is life in prison, which is probably true. 23 hours in solitary confinement, and I mean, it's really an awful life. But that's not the reason we don't do capital punishment, because we can give someone a worse punishment. That's vengeance, is what that is. Illinois, so we'll look at this. Illinois abolished the death penalty in 2011, and Governor Quinn at the time, do I have the quote there?
Yep.
Oh yeah, I did have it. It says, since our experience has shown that there's no way to design a perfect death penalty system free from the numerous flaws that can lead to wrongful convictions or discriminatory treatment, I have concluded that the proper course of action is to abolish it. Now, if Illinois had a moratorium on the death penalty starting with Governor Ryan, I think that was in 2001, and Quinn, 10 years later, said really pushed to abolish it entirely. So the viewpoint of Illinois lawmakers, and I think it's helpful to understand the other side. Perhaps some of you are on the other side. You know, I think it's helpful to understand where the different viewpoints with something like this. But Republicans largely favored the death penalty both in principle and in practice. Some of them were law enforcement, had a background in law enforcement and favored it for that reason. Democrats actually spoke in favor of it in principle. I mean, there are many, many Democrats, I recall, just talking about it. In principle, they favored it. It was in practice, they questioned it. They didn't support how it was being practiced in Illinois. And let me give you this to think about, because it's easy to say, well, it's biblical that we should be doing it. When you start to dig into these things, you kind of say, okay, I support it in principle. In practice, there's some things to think about with that. This is what they kept going back to. In the 1980s and 90s, 14 capital offenses were overturned. Proof came from DNA evidence, but also what's called the Burge scandal. Officer Burge was a captain of the Chicago PD in the 70s and 80s, and he's currently in prison, but he tortured different men and women to extract confessions from them of crimes they really didn't commit. And it was proved they didn't commit. So they give a confession. Some of them went to death row. That kind of thing caused a lot of lawmakers to think, we have put a lot of people have gone to death row, some have even been executed, that after the fact were shown to be innocent. And that, at the very least, ought to shake you of questioning, has our own state become so corrupt that we shouldn't be doing this? And so that's where the difference between Democrats and Republicans really were on this. Republicans were saying, we get it, we grieve, but we still should be doing this. Democrats were saying, we've become so corrupt, we shouldn't be doing this. If 14 men were on death row, some of which lost their lives because of our ineptness, we shouldn't be doing this. So at least respect the other view wherever you stand. It wasn't just throwing the Bible out. It wasn't just, oh, liberals do this and conservatives do this. There were a lot of emotion that went into this as they were thinking about it. But in principle, so I would say this, in principle, God requires government to execute murderers. You could look at Romans 13, 1 through 7 as well on that. It says that government does not carry the sword for no reason. And so it's talking about punishment in that way as well. But we have to understand and acknowledge no judicial system is perfect. Innocent people will die at times. However, in practice, some of the questions that come up is just, what is a humane means of ending life? The guillotine, crucifixion, those are not humane ways of ending life. public shaming and completely inappropriate because of the dignity of man being the image of God. Can we actually reduce wrongful convictions? That would have been if we still had the death penalty in Illinois, and even without it, but we ought to be asking that question. Can we reduce that? That ought to grieve us that our government is at times really has a problem with putting innocent people in prison and even taking their lives. But finally, when is a government too corrupt to justly execute people? So I think you can see there's more to it. When you're talking about it in principle, I think it's pretty simple where the Bible is on it. In practice, that third one is the question I kind of ask. I mean, who would say I support the government of North Korea executing murderers? Show of hands. Probably not too many. But then the question is, have we as a society become so corrupt that we shouldn't be doing it either? That's an interesting question. I think where I wanted to end today, I'll let you ask a few questions here, but I wanted to end with when you look at the thread that's going through Genesis, what you have is just that God always accomplishes his purposes. And so if you look in Genesis 3:15, that's the first promise that there was going to be a Messiah that was going to come. It says that he will crush, it's talking about the serpent. Messiah is going to come that's going to crush the serpent's head, referring to Satan, going to crush him. You will bruise his heel, he will crush your head. So from the time of Adam and Eve forward, God's people were looking for someone who was going to deal with their sin problem. So what happened? I mean, man became so corrupt and violent in Genesis 4, and all of this happens, and God didn't abandon that plan. And this is part of that. Why did God create capital punishment? Why did he institute capital punishment? It was part of that. We would have destroyed ourselves otherwise. I don't know that it's the deterrent. I don't think it's the deterrent that it should be today. I don't think that our society is using it appropriately for many reasons. However, that was the whole reason for it, is it would slow down the advance of sin in a society. We would have destroyed ourselves entirely if it was not for God taking action and intervening. It's kind of what Genesis 4 sort of is showing. And God saying in Genesis 6, the earth is just filled like a sponge, so to speak, filled with violence. Everybody just going around killing each other. And so this was instituted to prevent that, going back to Genesis 3, God's sovereign purposes would be accomplished. There would be a Messiah. God had said, I'm going to redeem man, and as surely as God fulfills his promises, he is going to do that. And so you see that thread over and over again, that whatever happens, God's purposes always stand. There's going to be a Messiah, and we look back on that 2,000 years ago. There certainly was one and is one today. But any final thoughts on this?
This class really screwed me up. I had all this settled in my mind.
Oh, no. I said it's biblical.
I like the guillotine without the crown.
Well, and the truth of that one, it actually wasn't fast. They didn't sharpen those blades. No, it was, again, it was all about shame and torture and, yeah, that's why the reaction to this whole topic. But, Alan.
I have one thought about this. If a person who's committed multiple murders and things, like John Wayne Gacy, killed 25 kids, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. But the one thing he knows, you know, if you put him in prison and say, you know, you're going to spend the rest of your life in prison, yeah, but they get used to some of that, you know, to some extent. But if you know next Thursday you're going to die and you're going to face a guy, then you really start thinking.
Yeah, and that discourages others from going down that path. And that's much closer to God's intent with capital punishment. But then you get into the question, I mean, because we're, how much time, how much evidence, how much, exactly, right.
I can't remember the guy's name, but there was one famous murderer in that, and he got convicted, but it was life in prison in the state he was in, and then it was another state. But he kept escaping, and he would kill guards, anybody. It didn't matter because he knew he wasn't going to die from it. Then I think he ended up in Texas or Florida, and he did get the death penalty, you know.
Now, Texas is a little faster at that.
Yeah. But one thing about it, he just never felt he was ever going to get it. You know, he always figured he was just going to go back to prison. So if he killed you and three or four others on the way out, it didn't matter to him. And, you know, something like that, it's a deterrent to him. Of course, it's really a deterrent once they do the execution. Then he will not kill anybody else. But
that's true. We know that for sure.
Look what happened when they put all those people in prison for the rest of their life. Look at what it does to taxes. Taxes are high enough now. You leave them nothing. What?
Actually, and there is an argument to that, but because of all the litigation that goes with death row, it's the cost is monumental. I think they figure for every person on death row, it's like $500,000 is spent up to the time of execution, if that even happens. And so the costs just keep mounting and mounting and mounting.
Because it's a forced appeal, you have to appeal it.
It also varies from state to state, because I'm originally from Texas, and a few years ago, or maybe a little longer, they were talking about capital murder, and Texas had more people executing capital murder than the other 49 states combined.
Yeah, I think out of the 1,500 executed since 1976, one-third of them have been in Texas.
So. And I was listening to that, and I was sort of, remind me of a conversation. I decided to go to college late in life, so I was one of the older ones, and this one professor had something about capital murder, and he had it in groups. And if you had a good argument, you'd give extra points. I needed extra points. So I was against capital murder, and everybody was arguing. I was the oldest one there, and everybody was arguing with me, that, and we got extra points, and the class was over. They just didn't understand why I was against. I said, no, I'm for it. Then why would you argue against it? So I need the extra points. Well, we do too.
That's great.
Well, but the point is that's just, and this were the young ones, you know, they were 18, 19, 20, you know, they were, and that surprised me. I figured there would, few of them would have been against it, but.
Yeah.
So are there good examples, like we say in principle, it's what's in the Bible, but in practice, are there good examples of how, like the third question, when is a government too corrupt to justly execute, or are there good examples of a way to do that in a just way that's humane and not? Do we have those examples, or do we know those examples?
Why don't you? Oh, you're talking about in America?
Yeah, or just in general. If that's what the Bible is saying, then what is a good way to carry this out in practice?
I'm hesitant because, like, we as a society, we're very concerned with being humane. So I'd like to say most of the means that we've used to carry it out, lethal injection, firing squad, things that are very quick, make sense to me. But, I'm not the final, that's just my opinion. I mean, I'm speaking a little more just on my opinion. I don't have a lot of biblical support because I can give a principle that because we're the image of God, it should be humane.
Right.
Hashing that out, I'm getting more into the realm of Sean's opinions.
Yeah. It's like, how do we know? Like, how do we get to those conclusions then?
I think it's good if you're wrestling with it, I think you're on the right track. But just to dismiss it, and I don't think that's how we want to do it. I mean, if you're really wrestling with it, I think you're on the right track. But,
they stoned them. There's nothing quick or humane about that. Unless you got a good one.
It was quicker, but that's a whole nother subject beyond today, like how that fits in. But Was this mostly kind of helpful? You can see sort of what, some things to think about with this, why God instituted this, how it fits in. I hope that's helpful. Again, I really do apologize that it is Mother's Day and we're talking about capital punishment. There's no underlining meaning or connection there or anything like that. But thank you for listening. Thank you for asking questions at this. And next week we will not have class. We are having an all-church congregational meeting. So come to that. 2 weeks from now, we are getting away from government, these topics, and looking at responding to our political leaders. So we're going to focus mostly on prayer in 2 weeks from now, what the scriptures say about our response as Christians. And we'll get into that a little bit more. But let me close our time in prayer. Father, thank you for just your grace and your mercy, even in something as awful as this topic today, the taking of a human life. We see even a glimpse of your grace, how you institute this so that way we would not be intent on just destroying ourselves with violence. It was meant to be a deterrent. It was meant to be as a part of your plan that we would not destroy ourselves and a Messiah would come and you would ultimately save us. Lord, I thank you for this opportunity. And I want to pray that you would bless the remainder of our day as we go from here. Pray for just those of us that are here that are mothers or are going to be celebrating Mother's Day. Really thank you for each of them. And I pray that you would bless the time that they have with their families. Lord, you are a good and gracious King. And we thank you for the opportunities that we have to look into your word. Some topics are easier to study than others, but you've given them all the same, and it's for us to be like good Bereans, to study your word and understand it and to think it through and apply it to our lives. Bless us as we go from here, and we ask that in your name. Amen. You are dismissed.